Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started? So I told you I want to spend the last few weeks of class focusing on some international law aspects and sort of comparative law aspects as well of conflicts problems. And I approach the three legs of the conflicts problem just from an international perspective. So I want to start by talking about choice of law issues, particularly the choice between domestic and foreign law in U.S. courts, talk about the one part that we didn't talk about here previously, which is adjudicatory jurisdiction, the extent to which U.S. courts can exercise personal jurisdiction over foreign defendants, and a little bit about the extent to which foreign courts will exercise jurisdiction over U.S. defendants, and then conclude by talking about recognition of U.S. judgments abroad and recognition of foreign judgments in U.S. courts. So start by looking at that legislative choice of law issue, and this is the one area where I'm going to focus exclusively on the use of foreign law in U.S. courts and not really talk at all about the introduction or application of U.S. law over in foreign courts. I know nothing about that, and I suspect it doesn't happen very often, so that's why we'll focus this way. Anyway, so one thing I hope struck you from reading the opinions, in particular the Hartford Insurance opinion, but also I think the first opinion, the Lorenz opinion, is that courts treat this problem of when to apply U.S. law instead of foreign law a little bit differently than they do when they start thinking about whether to apply Nebraska law or Arkansas law in a given case. Specifically, they frame the question as I just framed it, which is basically a question of statutory interpretation or legislative intent. They basically kind of, the Supreme Court starts from the question of, does this U.S. law, does it look like Congress intended it to apply to this situation? And if it does, then that pretty much answers the question, although there may be some conflicts issues kind of interwoven within how they get to figuring out what the scope of legislative intent is. Keep in your mind, like, is there any good reason for distinguishing a conflict between U.S. law and foreign law, or the way we treat a conflict between U.S. law and foreign law, from the way we treat truly interstate domestic conflicts? I don't know, a couple of reasons people have suggested is that maybe in the context of conflicts between federal U.S. law and foreign law, there's perhaps greater separation of powers questions or concerns. Can anybody think of why that might be? I mean, just think about the example. So going like up until this point where we're just talking about state-to-state choice of law, we've seen conflicts between guest statutes, which, by the way, many of those cases actually were international cases. The courts never really acknowledged that, but Canada actually is a foreign country, not one of our states. We've seen questions about interspousal immunity, wrongful death damages. Here today, we have questions about differences in antitrust law, British versus U.S. antitrust law. Differences in maritime law. Can you think of any reason why courts might be more concerned about conflicts that involve conflicts between U.S. law and some foreign country and be more likely to approach the problem as a problem of just statutory intention, like what Congress intended the reach of the U.S. statute to be? Why do these pose some more separation of power concerns, do you think? Do they? Yeah.
Towards the president's exclusive right to make treaties,
or? I think you're the president and Congress, right? I think one of the reasons, first of all, there's always a concern when you're talking about whether or not to apply a statute in a given case, when a court is deciding whether or not to apply a statute in a given case, whether we're talking about an interstate case, an intrastate case, or a case with international components, there ought to always be a little bit of a separation of powers concern. There's always the question about the extent to which courts can refuse to abstain from exercising jurisdiction that the legislature has provided, both in terms of the court's adjudicatory jurisdiction and the legislative jurisdiction. So my drift is, if Ohio passes a law that makes it illegal to text while driving statewide,
and the justices of the Ohio Supreme Court thinks that's a stupid law, but not unconstitutional, there's not a whole lot of good grounds for them to just say, we're not going to force that, right? That would raise separation of power concerns. And the same thing in all the conflicts cases we've seen, when a court's deciding about whether it's going to enforce or apply its own interspousal immunity law or employer liability law versus that of some other state, there ought to be a little bit of a separation of power concern that the court has somewhat limited ability to just refuse to apply a statute that the legislature has enacted and intended to apply to a given situation. In the interstate context, I think the concern about separation of powers is a little bit less, not as heightened, for two reasons. One is, so all these cases have not always involved statutes. The examples I put on the board do, right? But a lot of the law we're talking about in those interstate conflicts cases are common law cases. To the extent that what the court is doing is choosing to apply or not apply its own common law that it has developed, much less of a separation of powers concern. We already have a comfort level that state courts are out there developing common law and contracts and torts and property all the time, and how they choose to develop that common law doesn't really raise the same separation of powers concern. I think you're right, too, that to the extent that we're talking about conflicts, we're talking about a court deciding whether or not to apply a statute, even in the state-to-state concern or situation, our concern about separation of powers is not as strong as it is when we start talking about conflicts between federal law and foreign law, because we're worried that we're getting a little bit closer to the court being involved or potentially interfering with foreign relations power that's been delegated to the other branches. So maybe that's why that raises a little bit more of a concern. Any other ideas? There's not any really good source to put constraints on the court for choice of law, right? You know, we talked about, as modest as they may be, the Constitution to some extent restrains the ability of the lower courts in deciding those state-to-state conflicts. Not as much of a constraint out there on the courts in deciding whether or not to apply federal law in lieu of foreign law. So maybe that's a reason for the difference of approach. Maybe it's just that the Supreme Court has treated these cases differently because it has. I don't know, but maybe there's a little bit of justification. But anyway, so I say if you read these cases, the court really starts from the assumption of, okay, there's this U.S. statute. Is it intended to apply extraterritorially? And if it is, that kind of is the end of the story, maybe with a little bit of room for comedy concerns. That being said, the court is not completely without, they're not completely lacking any appreciation for limits that international law might place or kind of norms under international law. So anybody pick up from these first two cases, the Supreme Court's kind of gives you like a two-step framework for how it decides whether or not to apply a congressional statute. You'll start with the Jones Act case. That's a case in which a Danish sailor is in port at New York, gets hired by a Danish ship in New York in an employment contract that dictates Danish law will apply, goes out, sails, gets injured off the shore of Cuba, and then decides to pursue an action in the court in the United States under the Jones Act. Anybody read the Jones Act? I think it's quoted in the case for you. It's in footnote one there. If you just read the language of the Jones Act, does it apply to the case that the court has? Any seaman who shall suffer personal injury in the course of his employment may, at his election, maintain an action for damages at law with the right of trial by jury, and in such action, all statutes of the United States modifying or extending the common law right or remedy in cases of personal injury, railroad employees shall employ. Okay, so this were first year class in, I don't know, pick torts, contracts, legislation, whatever you want to have, and I said to you, what are the elements of a claim under a Jones Act? What would you say? Yeah. Okay, plaintiff has to be a seaman. Very good. We got it.
Personal injury in course of employment.
Yep. Okay. I think you're right. You pretty much got it, right? Okay. Does that apply? Does it look on its face like it applies? Is the injured plaintiff here a sailor? Yes. Was he injured in the course of his employment? Yes. So on the face of this statute, it looks like the thing applies. Okay, that can't be the answer though, right? Why not?
Well, the court points out anytime anything ever happened in the world with a sailor being injured at work could fit within the purview of the statute.
Yeah, this has no territorial bounds on it at all. Now, it could be that that's intentional. Right? Congress could very well decide that it is so concerned about the rights of injured sailors that it wants to enact a statute that provides redress for every injured sailor in the world. But the court here doesn't think that's what's happening. Okay, that ought to tell you one thing. The court essentially is starting from a presumption that statutes do not apply extraterritorially. In fact, both the majority and Scalia's dissent in the Hartford case, which is a more contemporary case, both of them expressly say that. We start from the presumption that Congress, when it passes these statutes, just isn't really thinking about the territorial effect. And so they're just thinking about the wholly domestic case, and that's how they mean them to apply. And we'll only apply a statute extraterritorially if we have some reason to think Congress truly intended that. Now, here's where I think the cases depart a little bit from just our typical normal cases about statutory intent, and this is what gives them the international component. Coupled with that presumption that the court says we presume Congress doesn't intend to act extraterritorially, in interpreting, in figuring out that congressional intent, the court's got another limitation. Anybody pick up on what the other limitation is? Yeah.
To not violate the law of another nation, if it's possible to construe the statute that way?
Yeah, and I would say that a little bit more broadly. And I think, again, I think the court, and particularly Scalia in his dissent, but the majority, too, in Hartford is a little bit more articulate about this. The court is going to presume that a statute is not intended to apply extraterritorially and also presume that Congress did not intend to violate the or to apply the statute in a way that would violate international norms or international principles. And that's maybe the international component here, how the court's treating these cases a little bit differently. If Congress really wants to apply a statute extraterritorially and wants to do so in a way that would violate international norms, Congress has to really be clear about that, make certain that that's really what it's intending to do. Okay, so you need to know a little bit about international law, which I don't think your casebook does a particularly great job about highlighting for you, and that is there's probably like five generally accepted. Anybody take international law? Anybody? So, yes, no. Don't want to admit that you did. That's okay, because you're afraid I might ask you questions about it. I understand, right? Okay, so one of the things that's a little bit tricky about international law is figuring out what international law is, because international law is different than domestic law. We don't have a whole lot of nice, like, international legislature out there that passes international statutes. We have a lot of norms, customs that we believe are generally accepted among nations, and hence they're kind of international law. We have some with a little bit more formality because we have conventions and treaties that people sign on to, and clearly those are international law. Beyond that, we've got a lot of norms and customs that we kind of accept as international law without really a great system for enforcing those norms and customs, other than the fact that all nations kind of agree and enforce them domestically. But to the extent we could discern what principles, and I leave that to Professor Turek to explain to you more artfully than I just did, but to the extent that we can actually come up with some norms about international law and a basis for jurisdiction internationally, we can say one norm is international law allows nations to apply their law territorially. Everybody kind of agrees that everyone is entitled to regulate people and property within its borders. Okay, if you think about that, so the court's presumption that Congress doesn't intend statutes to apply extraterritorially is really an acknowledgement of this. Presumably, if everybody, every nation, is allowed to exercise legislative jurisdiction, regulate people and property within its borders, this is like the old Pennoyer versus Neff, right? The converse of that, it's got to be true too. That means nobody else is allowed to exercise power over the people and property within your borders. Hence, we start with the, we're going to presume Congress doesn't mean to be invading the sovereign authority of other nations. Beyond that, everybody kind of agrees that nations have an ability to regulate their own nationals. The United States has the ability to regulate people and property within its borders. It also has the ability to regulate you as a citizen of the United States, no matter where you are. A little bit different, the passive personality principle, which we saw actually a little bit in the domestic context too, which is the idea that not only does every nation have the power to regulate its citizens abroad as well as at home, but it also has the ability to protect its citizens abroad as well as at home. Some caveats, though, to that. There has to be some expectation, you know, the actor has to have some expectation that the injured party is a citizen of another state and hence may be able to get the protections of that other state. But to some extent, everybody acknowledges that nations have some ability to protect their citizens. This one, we kind of know, makes sense. Everybody thinks and agrees that they have the ability to apply their own law to protect their own national security interests, for sure, maybe even national economic interests. And then there's this idea of universal jurisdiction, which is a lot of times in the news these days. There are some substantive principles that are universally held norms. Piracy is a good example of this. All nations agree that piracy is a bad thing, is a wrong. If we all agree to these universally held norms, every nation has the ability to enforce those norms in cases with its own law, in cases even if those cases have no connection. This is a pretty small subset, and it turns out a pretty controversial thing for everybody to agree on exactly what those universally held norms are. Maybe today, maybe terrorism, maybe. Human rights violations, maybe. Okay, so as we go through, you see the court's kind of using these international principles as a way to limit the extraterritorial reach of US law. All right, we start out with this guy. We say, okay, we're going to presume the Jones Act really isn't meant to cover every sailor everywhere, no matter what happens, but instead we're going to presume that it's just meant to cover the territory within the United States. And then, you know, after that, this opinion pretty much looks like a normal conflicts case, right? The court then says, so we're going to presume that Congress did not intend us to interpret the Jones Act in a way that that contradicts universally held maritime law. And it turns out that maritime law provides that we ought to look at the contacts that each potential state has and determine which state has the greatest contacts and apply that law. Although, note, this is a little bit different because at the end of the day, what is the result in this case? What happens to the plaintiff in this case? Really going to apply Danish law, you think? I mean, does it remand to the lower court to apply Danish law to decide whether this guy has a...
Well, no, because Danish law has already given him all the recovery that he can get.
Yeah, and you get the sense, though, that even if he had a claim under Danish law, that's not where this thing was headed, right? The court's not... I think that's another way in which this is... When I say that the court's really treating this as a case about statutory interpretation, does the U.S. statute apply? And if not... We're done. I think that's really what's going on. I mean, yes, it's convenient because he's already got the recovery, but I don't think the court would have remanded this under any circumstance to say, okay, you can go forward, just not under the Jones Act, under Danish law. And there might be good institutional reasons why that's true. So think about if you're, again, you're an Ohio court and you decide that West Virginia law should apply and you remand for the court and instruct the lower court to apply West Virginia law, that's one thing. Because chances are, although West Virginia law may differ from Ohio law, it's not going to differ all that significantly. You could probably, as an Ohio lawyer, figure out what West Virginia law is and figure out how to apply it in a way that would be consistent with the way West Virginia courts are. On the other hand, in the foreign setting, a little bit more challenging. There is a chance that Danish law might be different enough that it would be difficult for a U.S. court to figure out how to apply it and adapt it to a U.S. setting in a way that would really be consistent and true with Danish law. Okay, so why is it then ultimately that the court decides that the U.S. does not have an argument to apply, or the sailor anyway, doesn't have an argument that the Jones Act ought to apply? Yeah? Yeah, you're right. So think about it. The court goes through and it identifies some contacts for you. One is the place of wrong. That's Cuba here. Another, the court says, is the law of the flag, which is, anybody figure out what the law of the flag is? Yeah, that's right. Every ship's got to be registered in some country. Here, that's Denmark, right? Or did it register somewhere else? I can't remember. Was it Denmark? Yeah. Okay. The law of the plaintiff's domicile. Talks about the ship owner's allegiance. Anybody pick up on how that's different from the law of the flag?
I think it's because a lot of times ship owners will register to fly new ships in.
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially the principal place of business versus state of incorporation issue, right? A lot of corporations are incorporated within the state of Delaware, but truly, they're a Ohio corporation. That's where their principal place of business is. That's their allegiance. Same idea. The ship owner may choose to register in a different nation to take advantage of particularly favorable laws, but has some allegiance ultimately. It turns out that's not what's going on in this case. And then what's their last concern here? Law of the contract for the U.S. I think, okay, so a couple of things. Would the U.S. have some basis to exercise jurisdiction in this case? Maybe, right? After all, this isn't completely devoid of any connection to the U.S. This is an employment relationship that was entered into in the United States. Now, the court dismisses that and says, but this is really a tort case. Maybe if this was a contract dispute, maybe this was an employment contract dispute, okay. You also have the problem that the parties have a choice of law clause within the contract, which seems to suggest maybe not U.S. law. Maybe there's an argument. But ultimately, the court concludes, maybe as a matter of comedy, that Danish law ought to apply. You know, by the way, why is it in the U.S. interest? Because one of the arguments that the sailor makes here is that it's actually probably in the U.S. interest to apply U.S. law to this case and a lot of cases like it. Anybody follow how it is that they make that argument? It's just a throwaway. The court doesn't take it very seriously, but yeah.
I think the Jones Act is a potential liability that U.S. flag and domiciled ships have to take account of when they buy insurance or go into business, and that other ships from other countries don't have to, and then it would put all shipping on a level playing field because they would all have to account for the Jones Act.
That's exactly the argument, right? And you can look at it. It's a disincentive to register your ship in the United States, which we may think is a bad thing. Maybe we think there's a good business to be had in getting ships registered here. But the bigger issue is that for those ships that are registered in the United States, it puts them at a competitive disadvantage. It's more costly for them to do business. And so applying this would actually perhaps further the United States national economic interest to essentially make everybody in the world adhere to, or at least anybody who's arguably connected in any way with the United States, does business in U.S. ports of call, to make them somehow have to adhere to this higher standard of liability. Yeah? Why do you think it is the court, just forget it, talk to the legislature about that, but we don't even really think that's true. Why do you think it is, as a matter of just kind of strategic thinking, is it in the court's interest here to not apply the Jones Act? If you were to bring this case, if the injured sailor here was really doing this as a matter of principle, and he and his lawyer were to go and lobby Congress, do you think Congress would be likely to extend the extraterritorial reach of the Jones Act? So the second case is about antitrust. And antitrust has been I studied as a visiting law student in a law school in England in the early 90s. And I have to tell you, antitrust law was a really big bone of contention with my professors over there. They really disliked the scope of American antitrust law. We'll talk a little bit about personal jurisdiction and recognition and enforcement of judgments, but it was fairly difficult at the time anyway to get a U.S. antitrust judgment enforced in British courts. They felt that U.S. courts exercised extremely vast jurisdiction over foreign defendants. And they felt that the U.S. antitrust law was far too rigorous. The idea of treble damages was of great offense to all of my English law professors, and the extent to which the U.S. attempted to regulate conduct. But I think, so one of my professors is very dear, this man with this great Welsh accent, he said, the difference is all in this, my dear. You refer to it as antitrust law. We refer to it as competition law. We refer to it as extraordinary jurisdiction. You crassly refer to it as long-arm jurisdiction. That sums it all up. People in the United States were pretty aggressive about pursuing antitrust judgments against foreign defendants. Conversely, the European Union was not particularly thrilled with the extent to which Americans were doing that. Today, well, probably not today, but maybe 10 years ago, tables were turned a little bit. Europeans were very aggressive in asserting their competition laws over U.S. defendants and some of their other, like, worker and product safety regulations on U.S. companies operating in England, and Americans not so responsive to that. Back to my question about the sailor. Why do you think that Congress would be likely to extend the scope of the Jones Act to this sailors like this guy who just happened to pass through the port of call and enter into employment contracts? Why might you, as a legislator, be interested in that? Why might you be concerned about doing that? Yeah.
I think they might be concerned because of the product of the judiciary, if they were to say everybody that gets...
Okay, so one thing, as a legislator, you might genuinely be concerned about the burden on U.S. courts. And that's true. I mean, you'll see legislators and courts invoke that frequently as a reason to restrict foreign plaintiffs in particular access to U.S. courts. It's a concern about a flood of litigation that U.S. courts can't handle. What else might give you some pause? Yeah.
It's always the,
kind of complex balancing when it comes to trade of how protectionist to be or how free trade.
And that's the and this is the real story with the U.S. and the European Union and these kind of jacking over anti-competition laws, antitrust laws, however you want to think about them, and worker safety laws and product safety laws. And on the one hand, when people were very aggressive, particularly in the 60s and 70s, in asserting U.S. antitrust action against foreign defendants, that was pretty easy to do. The U.S. had pretty good bargaining power. The U.S. economy was very strong. European countries were interested in getting American goods into the country to European consumers. Foreign defendants were interested in getting access to the American market. And so, pretty good. On the other hand, as the EU became a stronger economic force, not surprisingly, the European Union began to assert kind of a greater reach of its laws and try to enforce its norms on American corporations that wanted to have access to European markets. Okay, one of your concerns as a legislator might be this real, very real concern about retaliation, right? That, okay, we can impose higher obligations on shippers who want to have any connection with the U.S., but in return, we may see foreign nations exercising or attempting to exercise authority over U.S. defendants and impose greater restrictions on them. We talked about this a little bit when we were talking about choice of law between the states, how in theory, you know, you could have states negotiate over the best way to maximize all of their interests, to kind of allocate legislative authority in a way that maximizes their interests. To some extent, I think that to the extent that really happens, it happens in the international setting a little bit. And part of what's animating the court's decision about whether to apply U.S. law or really to apply U.S. law very sparingly, extraterritorially, is this desire about promoting comity to actually prevent retaliatory application of foreign law against U.S. defendants. In fact, in the first case, the Supreme Court even talks about that. You know, comity is important, lest, you know, all of a sudden, whatever we say, whatever context we say warrant the application of U.S. law, we should be aware that U.S. defendants with similar context with foreign nations, that'll be an argument to assert foreign law. So a little bit of that going on. Okay, if you think about it, these contexts ultimately match up pretty nicely, although the court doesn't talk about that, with these limits on international jurisdiction. U.S. has any interest here, it's potentially a territorial interest, although the court thinks ultimately this isn't a case that really invokes the territorial interest because it really isn't about regulating the contractual relationship. And ultimately, these other contacts suggest that maybe Denmark has a greater claim of legislative jurisdiction over here. So if not as an outright, we don't have jurisdiction, certainly as a matter of comity, Danish law to apply here. And with the express Danish law to apply because we don't want the tables to be turned. We don't want a U.S. injured sailor on a ship owned by a U.S. corporation registered in U.S. to be subject to Cuban law or Danish law. The other thing I think that's kind of noteworthy is if you look at the time that this case is decided, 1953, and you go back and you look at those center of gravity cases and those early interest analysis cases, the methodology that the Supreme Court's using is pretty consistent with what those courts in New York were doing. This really is kind of a center of gravity, measure the context, see who has the most significant context, very well aligned. Contrast that, I think, with what the Supreme Court's doing now in the Hartford case, which seems to be a little bit disaggregated or out of joint with what the states are doing. So in Hartford, you've got the two competing opinions. You know, I said the court starts from the presumption that Congress does not intend laws to apply extraterritorially. But note here, both the majority and the dissent actually say the opposite, right? They say, well, that's the presumption, but here, clearly, antitrust laws apply extraterritorially. Anybody pick up on why that is?
Is it just the policy reasons for having antitrust laws that it would adversely affect American consumers?
That is ultimately what it is. You got to look carefully. It's kind of, I've asked you kind of a trick question. I don't think the majority or the dissent ever gives you a really good answer why it is that U.S. antitrust law plays extraterritorially. Anybody find, does the court quote you the statutory language at all? So in footnote 23, you say, it tells you that one of the amendments to the Sherman Act provides, the Sherman Act doesn't apply unless such conduct has a direct, substantial, and reasonably foreseeable effect on domestic or import commerce. And by the way, just so we're all clear, everybody figure out what's going on in this case, why it is that U.S. antitrust laws apply. Who's the plaintiff, who's the defendants in the case? It's actually a group of plaintiffs, and the court tells you 19 states and many private plaintiffs, California being one of those states. And what's their, and it's actually, I think, a group of defendants ultimately, too. All the defendants are British insurance companies. Why do these states think they have a claim under the Sherman Act against these British insurance companies? Are any of the British insurance companies selling insurance in any of the states? No, they're not. They're all reinsurance companies. So we've got to be careful about exactly what's going on here. All of these defendants essentially buy up insurance risk that other insurance companies have insured. Somewhere out there, there's a U.S. insurance company that is selling insurance policies to individuals and companies, because given the nature of these policies, in California and 19 other states, and covering different types of environmental risk. Rather than holding that risk themselves, that insurance company, that U.S. insurance company, turns around, goes over to London, and sells its insurance contract to these British defendants, who pool that insurance contract with a bunch of others and absorb that risk. Okay, the allegation here is that these British insurance companies, wholly on the British market, are refusing to buy these insurance contracts that American insurance companies have sold unless the American insurance companies, in turn, refuse to underwrite certain environmental risks. Again, with this idea that they think that the U.S. environmental law environmental policies are too aggressive and provide and put too great a risk of loss on the insurance companies. Okay, so everything's happening in London. All of these defendants are in London. They're buying or refusing to buy contracts in London. But the theory is that by doing that, they're essentially forcing what the American insurance companies can put in the insurance contract in California. Okay. So why is it then, or how is it that there is an argument that the Sherman Act ought to apply to these British defendants that are doing all of the whole, all their conduct is taking place on the London reinsurance markets? Yeah.
They're arguing that their conduct was meant to affect the insurance market in the United States.
Yeah, that ultimately this is an effects, if you want to talk about this in terms of like personal jurisdiction cases, you can make an analogy to. This is really about like an effects test based jurisdiction. Even though all of their conduct is taking place in London, the whole purpose of that British conduct is to affect what American insurance companies are doing in the United States, in these 19 states that are suing. Okay, does the Sherman Act reach that extraterritorial conduct? The Supreme Court starts, both majority and the dissent, even though they acknowledge a presumption, no, conduct should not reach extraterritorially, they both just say, ah, but clearly it does here. It's a little bit tricky. You don't get the full context of what's going on here. I think they say that because there's not really a good explanation for why. They're somewhat bound by precedent, and the Supreme Court has previously said that the Sherman Act is meant to reach that far and hence will apply it extraterritorially. But beyond that, there's not really a good argument for why this applies extraterritorially. And really the problem for the majority in the dissent is that the Supreme Court has held that other statutes, like Title VII, for instance, do not apply extraterritorially, even though Title VII has language that's about as generic as the Sherman Act. The Supreme Court has said one applies extraterritorially, one does not. And so neither has a really good reason for why it is, but they both take that as true. Okay, if it is true, presumption is that it applies extraterritorially, there's still that second question, which is, should the statute apply? Remember I said there's two presumptions the court's working with, presumption that it does not apply extraterritorially, and a presumption that Congress does not intend to violate norms of international law. And so then the second issue here is, and I think where the real disagreement between the majority and the dissent is whether or not this particular extraterritorial application will violate international law. Okay, so first of all, is there a basis here for the saying that the Sherman Act actually does apply extraterritorially? Does the U.S. have some basis consistent with international law to regulate the conduct here? Yeah.
Is that where the court uses the that if you can comply with both nations' laws?
Mm. Here's what I think. I think much like our domestic notions of personal jurisdiction, adjudicatory jurisdiction, have evolved beyond just a straight territorial people in power within the borders, right? Through international shoe, subsequent cases, we've recognized that effect within the borders is enough to confer jurisdiction. I think we're in the same place when we talk about international law and limits on legislative jurisdiction. That there's some idea that territorialism is a little bit more expansive than just things within the border, but also things that cause effect within the border. And so this is okay. This is clearly causing effects within the United States. Maybe there's also a little bit of this going on, right? That we can protect U.S. nationals to the extent that this is affecting, take the plaintiffs at their word, this is affecting the U.S. market for insurance. And these British defendants ought to know that. That's the whole point of why they're doing what they're doing. They know when they buy these risks, they buy these insurance companies, they're buying risk in the United States. We can apply our law to protect our own domestic markets and our own citizens in those domestic markets. So maybe there's a basis. Then the question is whether, as a matter of comedy, the U.S. ought to apply it or not. The majority never really answers that question, right? For the majority, it sees this as a two-step thing. One, does the statute apply? Yes. Should the U.S. abstain as a matter of comedy? Well, you only have to figure that out if there's a true conflict between U.S. law and the law of some foreign nation, here, British law. And you're right, the court says, well, there's no true conflict because you could comply with U.S. antitrust regulations without violating British law. Which is not exactly the way we've been talking about conflicts thus far in conflict class, but that's sort of the way that the majority gets around.
Justice Scalia instead actually attempts to identify the contacts that the United States has, the contacts that the British have, and figure out really who has the more significant interest. So what are some of the contacts he sees here between this lawsuit and the United States? Okay, so that's a contact he sees with the UK. That's where the actual trades are. That's where the alleged agreements, because really the thing that violates the Sherman Act is the fact that they all agree to do this. That's where the British reinsurers agree to refuse to buy contracts that are covering certain environmental risks. Be an advocate for a minute. What do you see as the context between these? Let me ask you this. How many people think that this really would be a good case for the U.S. to apply the Sherman Act? How many people think not? That U.S. law should not apply? Okay, so let's talk about why it is that we think that. So those of you who think that there is a good argument to apply U.S. law here, why?
Because it pretty significantly affects the way
And this isn't very far along in discovery, so we don't know a whole lot, but if you're actually going to make this case, what do you need to know in order to really argue this successfully? So if you're litigating this thing, you're going to go forward, you need to get some discovery, you need to do some factual investigation. If you really want to make the case that the U.S., this case is intricately connected with the U.S. because the effects are felt in the domestic market, I think you need to do a little bit more factually to make that a compelling argument. Yeah. Okay, you got to start by seeing what the effect really has been on insurance rates in California and other states. But I think more than the effect, the rates, the availability, right? For this thing to work, the factual assumption is that these domestic insurers can only sell policies at an affordable rate if they can reinsure the risk. I believe that's probably true. We need to demonstrate that factually. And that the only way they can reinsure the risk is in the British markets. So if you can go to Denmark and reinsure, too bad about you. Who cares that you can't get it from the British reinsurers? Go do it in Denmark or Asia somewhere, right? So if you're going to actually make this case, you got to fill in a little bit more facts. But okay, at the stage we're at, fine. The idea is this is going to have a significant effect on the U.S. market. You need to reinsure in order to get people to issue the policies, and they have to be able to reinsure through the London markets. Anything else? Yeah.
Did you use the argument that the UK insurance companies wouldn't be kind of colluding if the U.S. had someplace else to go and could just totally take their business elsewhere?
Yeah. Okay, people who think this is not a good argument, right, that U.S. law should not apply here, why not?
I haven't read, obviously, the legislative intent stuff about the Sherman Act, but it just doesn't seem to me what they were thinking of.
Okay.
It doesn't seem that it's enough of an effect that they would want it to apply.
So what would you think you'd want to see in the legislative history to say there's enough of an effect?
I would want some sort of operation going on in the United States. I mean, not just in effect, but like an insurance company that had a place of business in the United States that they were operating out of, or just more intent shown that this is exactly what they were trying to do.
What's the real concern? What's the real concern you have with applying it to foreign nationals like this that are causing an effect in the U.S. market? Yeah.
Well, I mean, the law only regulates United States, or you could argue that it only regulates the conduct of businesses in the United States.
You could.
Their practices. So.
But like, I mean, like beyond, why is a policy matter? Like, what's the policy you're concerned about? Give it. I mean, the whole point of this thing. What do you think, what do you perceive to be the policy behind the Sherman Act, U.S. antitrust laws? Yeah.
To encourage competition in the economy.
To encourage a competition in the U.S. economy? I think I would hear, you guys would say U.S. economy, right? Yeah, and why is that a good thing? Is it just an inherent good in and of itself, or do we think that there are some other goods that flow from encouraging competition in the U.S. economy?
Forcing companies to compete with one another in the market to the benefit of people who buy their services.
Okay, so if this is really about promoting competition in the U.S. markets, really to provide more choice in the U.S. markets, and then in turn to provide goods and services at a lower cost because there is more choice, is there an argument for applying this extraterritorially? Yeah, if we really believe that this is affecting rates and the availability of environmental insurance in the U.S. market. On the other hand, what might be a counterpoint to, even if that's true, why might we still say that this is not a good place to apply U.S. law?
Would you argue that you want to have a boundary on that somehow, so that because the U.S. economy is so big that if you have any sort of tangential connection with the U.S. economy, then you would be incurring that liability.
Okay, so we've got fear of this just providing worldwide liability that's too broad in scope. Again, maybe that's bad because it just opens the U.S. courts up to more work than the U.S. courts can handle. Maybe it's bad because it discourages foreign businesses from doing business with the United States, and that might be counter to the purposes of the Sherman Act. We want to encourage competition in the marketplace. That surely must include competition from foreign players as well. Maybe it's bad because we're fearful of retaliation. Other countries exerting their antitrust laws or whatever other laws they choose to. Okay. So now, can you figure out a way to argue that this is a good case factually where we ought to create that boundary? Maybe just the fact that nobody has physical operations in the United States? Is that really the dividing line? So the Sherman Act should never apply to defendants that don't have physical operations in the United States?
The UK has their own system to regulate the insurance.
Okay, I think that's an important fact. And why is that an important fact? I think you can make two good arguments from that fact to suggest that this is a place to draw the line.
It's kind of encroaching on their...
Okay, if we're really concerned about interfering with other states' interests and maybe prompting a retaliatory response, here's a case where the UK has an extensive regulatory system in place. Contrary to what the majority says, applying U.S. antitrust law is going to upset that regulatory system to some extent, right? UK allows this. So yeah, it's true, you can comply with both, but it definitely interferes with the regulatory and the economic policy that the UK has in place. And so maybe this is a good place to draw the border. When we can show that the potential foreign sovereign's interest really is in play because they are regulating the area and this will disrupt them. Not only that, anybody know anything about the British economy? This is a pretty significant part of the economy, hence the reason that they have the regulation that they have. So maybe that's a good thing. To the extent that we're worried about the harmful effects of what the defendants are doing, it's not as if this is going unregulated. It's going regulated. It's just that the foreign entity where the conduct's taking place has adopted a different regulatory scheme. So that's a good fact, maybe, that you can elicit.
Yeah.
Would the foreign insurers be able to argue that this would be something to be more appropriate for something like the WTO or something that's meant for international?
Perhaps, yeah, if there is I don't know that this is within the WTO's jurisdiction, but perhaps if there is an international body, that's an even further, another argument why this might be something where we shouldn't apply U.S. law, we should defer to some international agency that we've all agreed to, yes. I mean, honestly, I don't know. Anybody know? Is this within the WTO's jurisdiction? I don't know the answer to that. Any other ideas? Okay. It's a good start. One last thing that kind of bugs me about this case, just so we're all not confused about what's really going on. The majority talks about this in terms of jurisdiction, whether the case should be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction or whether the court should abstain from exercising its jurisdiction. I think that's kind of a dangerous thing to do. If I told you that the Sherman Act required intentional conduct, you had to show not just that they conspired, but that they had the intent to spitefully, willfully, and maliciously injure U.S. companies. It does not have such a, but if it did have such a requirement. And defendant's argument here was, look at what they've pled. At best, you can say that we're careless, we're reckless, but we certainly aren't being malicious. We're acting in our economic self-interest, but we're not being malicious in our desire and in our attempts to keep certain environmental risks, to not ensure certain environmental risks. Would the plaintiffs here, the states, have a cause of action? No, right? They wouldn't. Take the international aspect off the table. Make this about wholly domestic. U.S. plaintiffs suing U.S. defendants, and pretend that the Sherman Act has this goofy requirement, this heightened requirement of intent, right? That you have to show some mean, evil, not in your economic interest intent to exclude others from the marketplace. And the plaintiffs have pled a complaint that shows only that all the defendants are acting in their own self-economic interest. Sound vaguely familiar, by the way? Maybe not. Anyway. Should the case be dismissed? Yeah, you know the answer to this, right? If it's a tort case and the plaintiff's complaint shows that the defendant wasn't negligent, should the case be dismissed? Yes. If it's a contract case and the plaintiff's complaint shows that there was no consideration or that the contract wasn't breached, should the case be dismissed? Yes. If it's a Title VII case and Title VII requires intentional discrimination, and the plaintiff has proven nothing other than circumstantial evidence that there may be a disparate impact of the employment policy, should the case be dismissed? Yes. If the Sherman Act says, in order to show that someone has an attempt, parties have an attempt to are attempting to exclude others from the market, you have to show that the defendants acted in a way that was contrary to their own economic self-interest, and the plaintiffs have not pled any activity that would be contrary to the defendant's economic interest, should the complaint be dismissed? Yes. That's the facts in Twombly, by the way. If you're wondering why, I think that sounds vaguely familiar, right? Okay, the case should be dismissed. Is it dismissed because the court lacks jurisdiction? No. It's dismissed on the merits because the plaintiff has failed to meet one of the elements. We just happen to know from the pleading, as opposed to through the course of discovery, that the plaintiff can never meet the elements. It's hard to do, or used to be hard to do, pre-Twombly and Iqbal, but it can be done. Okay, has what the defendant's done here, is that any different? Aren't they really just alleging that the Sherman Act requires what you said, requires some domestic connection beyond an effect in the United States? I think so. So I'm a little bit troubled about talking about this, but about this in terms of jurisdiction. Now, you may say this is just because I'm a civil procedure professor and hung up on a small point, but who cares about it? But I do think it has some consequence, maybe not in this case, but could have some consequence if you're not careful. So if the court lacks, by the way, what would be the basis for subject matter jurisdiction? Did the court have subject matter jurisdiction over the plaintiff's complaint here? Sure. Why do I think the court had subject matter jurisdiction over the plaintiff's complaint? This is like the easy kind of federal question jurisdiction. They state a claim that directly arises under the federal statute. The Sherman Act is a federal statute, and it gives individual parties a right to sue, creates a cause of action. So no question, there's 1331 jurisdiction in this case. Trickier question. Did the court have personal jurisdiction over the British defendants? You won't find it in the case. Now you really got to like think that. This might help some ease some of your troubles about congressional intent. The Sherman Act has not just nationwide jurisdiction authorized in it, it has worldwide jurisdiction authorized in it. It literally authorizes the service of process on a defendant anywhere in the world you can find the defendant. Now, that in and of itself is not enough to confer personal jurisdiction, right? There's still some due process limits on the court's personal jurisdiction over these defendants. They have to maintain certain minimum contacts with the United States such that the exercise of jurisdiction will comport with traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. Did I get it right? Is that what the phrase is? I.e., do these defendants have minimum contacts with the United States? Would the exercise of jurisdiction be reasonable? Any idea? Don't get a whole lot of information, but yeah. They are ultimately buying insurance contracts up from American insurance companies in large numbers for substantial amounts of money. They probably have minimum contacts such that the exercise of jurisdiction is reasonable here. So there's subject matter jurisdiction over this dispute. There's personal jurisdiction. Does the court lack jurisdiction? No. This is really about whether the statute does apply and whether it should apply in the sense of, are the elements met here? Granted, we're not, just like we said with the Jones Act, there's no territorial element written in there. We're implying it. That's really what it is. Why does it matter? Okay, back to the court. Plaintiff sues the defendant in federal court, alleged seeking damages from a car accident case. Court dismisses because there's clearly on the face of the complaint no diversity. Plaintiffs and the defendant are citizens of the same state, and the amount in controversy cannot even in good faith exceed the amount in controversy requirement. Plaintiff sues the defendant in state court in the same exact accident. What result? Dismissal forward, right? Dismissal for the for lack of jurisdiction isn't a dismissal on the merits. You just go to an act case. The plaintiff sues the defendant in federal court alleging negligence in an auto accident. The court dismisses because on the face of the plaintiff's complaint, the plaintiff has alleged that the defendant was not negligent as a matter of law. The plaintiff turns around and sues the defendant in state court. What should the state court do with the lawsuit? Throw it out. Res judicata now applies, right? Clearly, res judicata applies. So maybe it does matter in the sense that calling this jurisdiction allows the parties maybe to file a subsequent suit somewhere else, whereas being honest about what's really going on might cause res judicata. Now, I don't think that's really a problem in here, in this case, because if the federal court's not going to entertain this lawsuit under the Sherman Act, there's nowhere else for these guys to go. Probably. State antitrust law, maybe. But in general, this idea of being clean about what you're doing is important because it could have consequences in a subsequent case. All right, any other questions?
The last case, the New Jersey case, I won't spend a whole lot of time on because I know we're getting late. But it's just another example of courts grappling with this issue of to what extent should they apply U.S. law, in this case state law, but U.S. law to transactions that have foreign connections. And I think that the New Jersey case is a nice case to go back through and read again for yourself to see if you can't follow the court's methodology, because I think the court does a really good job of breaking down these issues that we were talking about and addressing them pretty discreetly and pretty clearly.
The court starts with this idea of, does the New Jersey law actually apply to citizens abroad? Of course, this is kind of an odd setting because the New Jersey law is incorporating federal law. And so then the court gets to the question about whether or not federal law is really meant to reach this extraterritorial conduct. This is also a nice, easy one because it seems really clear that that's the whole point behind this law, is to reach conduct abroad. So it's not like the Sherman Act. It's not like Title VII. We don't have to have a lot of guessing games. It's clear that it really is meant to get there. And then does a really nice job, I think, after that, saying, okay, so once we've established that the law is actually supposed to apply extraterritorially, we still ultimately have this conflict because Swiss law is different than New Jersey law. And does a good job, I think, kind of doing a little bit of analysis about why it is that New Jersey has the greater interest and why it is that New Jersey law should apply. So it's, I think, a good kind of refresher of what we've done thus far, as well as giving you a little bit of a clear articulation, one more clear setting for this. Okay, any questions? All right, see you guys next time.